heard I, letting out a small gasp as the world turned into a black-and-white landscape with a few pastel brushes of sorcery dabbed across it. The privileged glowed brightly in the else, forcing Vlora to blink at the radiance. It took a few moments to notice that the privileged had not come unprepared for this eventuality, that there was a half-dome of hardened air just a few inches in front of him. It would be very difficult to punch through, and impossible to shoot around for all but the most skilled of powder mages. The Dionys, it seemed, had learned from the battles they'd fought against powder mages. Vlora shifted her attention to the woman sitting in the saddle just behind and to the right of the privileged. She also glowed in the else, and Vlora had seen enough bone eyes by now to know them by their aura. The privileged was focused on the battle ahead, no doubt trusting his shield of air, while the bone eye seemed focused inward. Vlora had no doubt she was spurring on her soldiers, giving them the courage to charge uphill against her rifle jacks. It was, so far, not working. Several hundred dragoons already littered the road, further slowing their compatriots. Flora's rifle jacks worked with mechanical precision, firing staggered volleys into whatever came next. It was utter suicide on the part of the dragoons, unless, of course, they were simply buying time for their privilege to reach the front and lend them a hand. Flora readjusted her grip, took a long, steady breath, and breathed out as she squeezed the trigger. As the bullet flew from the barrel of her rifle, she burned powder charges in her kit, adding extra strength to the shot, so that it would soar straight and true across nearly 1,000 yards of open terrain. As it approached the enemy, she nudged the bullet down and to the right. The bullet skimmed the outer layer of the privileged shield of hardened air and slammed into the bone eyes sitting next to him, snapping her head back and sending her tumbling from the saddle. The privileged whirled, watching his companion fall, right as a bullet tore through the base of his spine from the opposite direction. Another bullet killed the captain of the privileged guard, while 2 more bullets downed nearby officers. Flora allowed herself a victorious smile, glancing across the valley to where Taniel hid on the hillside opposite her. Somewhere to his left were Davd and Noreen, but Flora didn't take the time to pinpoint them before turning her gaze back to the battle. The Dionys faltered, the courage their bone eye supplied suddenly gone. Some tried to flee back down the column, though there was no space for them to go, while others abandoned their horses and took cover in stream beds and ditches. Flora found Olam standing with her rearguard, keeping them in check so that they held their ground. More than a few of them would want to press an attack, but Flora had no interest in taking a single step back toward Yellow Creek. The trap had drawn out the brigade's privileged and bone eye, and Flora pulled a mirror out of her pocket, flashing it toward Olam. He nodded toward her, giving an order to pull back. Let the Dionys stumble over their dead and wonder when the next ambush would come. In the meantime, the rifle jacks would march double time to catch up with the capstone and continue their sprint toward the coast. Flora was just about to climb down from her perch, when her preternatural senses picked up something she did not expect. Not up here. It was the sound of hooves on gravel, as well as the jingle of cavalry kit. It was, alarmingly, coming from behind her. She swung her rifle around and over a branch, shifting her position so that she could face toward the crest of the ridge behind her. To her surprise, she saw well over 100 Dionys cavalry in their shining breastplates mount the ridge and fall into line. She swore to herself angrily, wondering what damned goat track they'd found to be able to flank the riflejack position. The dragoons hadn't just been buying time for their privileged, they'd been buying time for their cuirassiers as well. The charge was not an ideal one. Through a screen of trees that hid the cuirassiers from the rifle jacks, across a tiny stream bed, and then over a rocky field. Not ideal, but certainly possible, and with success, it might be able to shatter her rearguard. The cuirassiers finished falling into line, and their officer raised his sword. "Piss and shit," Flora growled. She dropped her rifle to the ground, hoping it wasn't damaged in the fall, and awkwardly pulled her pistol. Just as the officer lowered his sword, she pulled the trigger, floating a bullet 50 yards and, with an extra flare of powder, put a neat hole through his breastplate. None of his cuirassiers seemed to notice him fall as they plunged over the lip of the ridge, charging through the screen of trees without a word, while the attention of the rifle jacks was split between shooting dragoon stragglers and preparing to pull back. Flora shouted for Olam across the valley, but the noise was lost among the screams of men and horses down the road. She swore again, reaching out with her senses, and set off the powder carried by the 6 closest cuirassiers. The kickback of the sorcery almost knocked her off a branch, but the blast had the intended effect, causing the cuirassiers to falter, and Olam and the rearguard to look toward their left. With her rifle dropped, Laura could do nothing but watch as Olam shouted, waving his sword in the air as he kicked riflemen into a loose line and gave the order to fix bayonets. It came not a second too soon, as the Dinai's cuirassiers slammed into the reeling riflejacks. Laura's heart leapt as Olam went down beneath the swinging sword of a cuirassier, and the line was broken by the sheer power of the charge. Taking her eyes off the fight, she glanced beneath her and leapt from her hiding spot, hitting the rocky ground hard and rolling into a crouch. Fetching her rifle and leaving her hat behind, she sprinted toward this new battle, fearing the worst. She reached the road in time to see the last of the cuirassiers pulled from his horse and butchered by angry riflemen. The length of their entrenchment was a scene of chaos, with horses and soldiers dead and dying in a 100-yard swathe. She could see in an instant that the cuirassiers had simply brought too few men. With an extra 100, they might have completely dislodged the rearguard, and even without them, their charge had been devastating. Her rearguard was still reeling from the hit. Officers attempting to organize their men back into ranks in case the dragoons mounted another attack. A dragoon charge did not come. Flora found Olam lying in the mud, blinking at the sky, his brow caked in blood. She dropped to her knees beside him, overcome by relief when his eyes immediately focused on her. "Are you all right?" she asked.
I think so. Caught a horse's knee to the fierce. Does it look bad?
It did.
You've had worse.
Olam struggled to stand up, and Flora put her arm beneath his shoulder to get him back to his feet so that they could survey the damage.
The dragoons are pressing,
Olam commented.
Too many dead clogging the road,
Flora responded. They won't be able to mount another charge at this point. All their cards were in that cuirassier charge.
Pit, that scared the shit out of me. Damn good thinking, detonating some powder. Otherwise they might have hit us before we even saw them.
Laura didn't feel as if she'd added much of anything to that fight. They should have seen that possible flanking maneuver and been ready for it. Frankly, she was furious with herself for overlooking it.
"Looks like our boys are pretty mauled. We need to grab our wounded and fall back. Double time."
"Agreed."
Olam pushed Flora away, testing his footing, then headed down the road shouting orders as if he wasn't still bleeding heavily from his forehead. Flora grabbed a nearby infantryman, pointing at Olam.
"Find the colonel a surgeon. Make sure he gets stitched up within 5 minutes," she ordered.
Flora spotted Taniel coming down the side of the opposite valley from her, his rifle slung over one shoulder. He stopped beside a dead cuirassier, watching one of the horses panicking in a nearby bush.
before finishing his walk toward Flora.
"Those cuirassiers just came out of nowhere," he commented. "I was so focused on the battle, I didn't see them until you caused a ruckus with that powder."
"I barely saw them in time myself, and they were right behind me," Flora responded. "I'm lucky one didn't spot me and put a bullet in my back."
She shook her head, staring bleakly at the carnage one more time. This was supposed to be a way of discouraging the Dianais. Clog the road, kill a few hundred of them, draw out their sorcery support, and then flee. Instead, the Dianais had managed to flank them in mere minutes.
"Whoever is in command isn't someone I want to play games with."
Daniel remained silent.
"Pit," Flora said softly. "Now we have wounded to haul."
"They'll slow us down less than the capstone."
"Yes, but we can ditch the capstone if we need to."
Daniel seemed surprised.
"You'd really do that?"
"Bert has the rest of the godstone. The cap won't do them any damn good. If we need to drop it, we drop it."
"It might do them some good," Daniel said hesitantly. "It's still potent old sorcery."
"It's not worth the lives of my men," Flora insisted.
Their argument was cut off by the arrival of one of Flora's scouts. It was a young woman, dusty and glassy-eyed from a hard ride, her horse worked into a lather. The woman didn't bother to salute before barking out her report.
"Mom, we've just caught sight of another Dianai's army."
Flora's head snapped up. "Where?"
"To our southeast. Two brigades, coming on quick. They're going to cut off our escape the moment we get out of the foothills."
Chapter 61 Thousands of Dianai's soldiers flooded every known entrance to the catacombs in the Landfall Plateau at 4 o'clock in the morning. It was an impressive display, carried out with a precision that Mikkel found almost startling. Hundreds of copies of the catacomb maps were made in the course of just a couple of days, each one sectioned into squares drawn in different coloured ink and assigned to a company of soldiers. The companies were divided into platoons, each one of which was equipped with lanterns, pole arms, pistols, swords, and a box of coloured string that an infantryman would unravel as they searched the tunnels to mark that they'd passed through. Mikkel watched as a platoon in their turquoise uniforms and steel breastplates hammered the lock off the iron bar door in the basement of an old church not far from the Capitol building, and rushed down through the church's cellar of ossuaries and into the darkness below. Mikkel held a lantern and a pistol, and he watched the last of the soldiers disappear with growing trepidation. He wasn't entirely certain which he feared more. Cornering Jatura in some cave where a lot of soldiers would die trying to bring him down, or not finding Jatura at all.
"Claustrophobic?" Tenek asked.
"Not particularly," Mikkel answered. "But I'm not made to go into a place without an easy exit, and instinct is a hard thing to overcome."
"If all these maps are right, we'll do just fine."
Tenek was carrying a whole satchel full of those maps over one shoulder, all the originals that Mikkel had found in the millinery. Not all of them had been copied, just the three with the most minute detail, and Mikkel wanted the rest on hand in case they needed to figure something out while they were deep underground.
"I am admittedly nervous about mass-produced maps done on the spur of the moment."
Tenek leaned toward him.
"I can't disagree. But we pulled in all the regimental cartographers to get this done. They weren't amateurs."
"I sure to pit hope not. How did you manage to organize this whole thing so fast?"
Mikkel glanced back up the stairs into the back of the church that they now stood beneath. He could hear voices up there, people shouting commands or asking for updates.
The church was a sort of command center, and Mikkel and Tenik and the two platoons accompanying them were a mobile version of that command center, sent to search the area directly beneath the Capitol building. A new squad of soldiers rushed down the stairs into the basement, squeezing in between Tenik and Mikkel, and following their comrades into the darkness. "Seriously, I'm damned impressed." Tenik waited until the soldiers had all disappeared before answering in a low voice,
"We got all this organized because most of these men know someone who's died to Jatura's bombs over the last month. Revenge is a powerful motivator."
They were joined by another squad, this one gathering around Mikkel and Tenik in the narrow space in the church basement. Mikkel glanced from face to face, noting the eagerness and hoping that none of them turned out to be claustrophobic. He took the satchel of maps from Tenik and looped it over his shoulder, then plucked one of them out, unrolled it, and turned it over on itself until he could hold it easily draped over one arm.
"All right," he said. "You've all been briefed by Tenik here, so I'll make this short. The Capitol building sits directly over a series of chambers that probably date back to the old Dionysus Empire. We're going to sweep those chambers, looking for hidden alcoves and nooks where a single man might hide."
He swept his finger over a route he'd planned out in pencil, then asked Tenik to hold his lantern closer. "Be on the lookout for any indication that someone had been living down here. Bedding, tools, gunpowder, even footprints in the dust. If the walls begin to close in on you, tell one of us, and then trace the string back up to the surface. Got it?"
"Yes, sir," a dozen voices responded.
"Good." Mikkel set aside the map and searched his valise for another, one of the older, more detailed maps that they didn't have copies of. He spread it across his lap and traced their route out one more time, making sure that they weren't going to miss anything by depending on the newer maps. The tunnels lined up with their plans admirably, and he was just about to roll the map back up when something caught his eye. It was a label on one of the dozens of chambers that they'd been searching, each of them marked by the cartographer with a single word in a language Mikkel wasn't familiar with. It was labelled Mara. The sight of the word made Mikkel's heart jump.
"Let's go," he told the soldiers. "Is something wrong?"
Tenik asked quietly as the soldiers headed down into the darkness.
"This word here," Mikkel pointed.
"What language is that?"
"Same language as the rest of those rooms, I'm guessing. Must be old Dionysus.
Do you know what it means?"
"Haven't a clue. Yarit might know."
The discovery troubled Mikkel as they followed their escort into the tunnels. He tried to shake it off, and had gone less than 200 yards when he decided that perhaps he should rethink the answer to that "Are you claustrophobic?" question that he'd been asked a few minutes before. The tunnel they followed sloped gently downward, the rock slick with moisture and lichen, the light of Mikkel's lantern playing across the uneven shadows. It was so narrow that he could touch both sides and the ceiling without reaching. Mikkel had always thought of the catacombs beneath landfall as something akin to a sewage system, in that everyone knew they were there, but no one really liked to talk about them. Some people were afraid of tunnel collapses, others that they were haunted. Most agreed that it was best not to disturb the rest of the ancient dead. They followed a zigzag pattern through a series of cross halls and small rooms filled with ossuaries, full-blown tombs, and even bones packed into alcoves so tightly that not one of them could be dislodged. He reined in the soldiers every few minutes, moving slowly and consulting his maps by lantern light, even though he had memorized their route. When it came to some place as disorientating as the catacombs,
He didn't want to make a mistake.
Their journey consisted of long stretches of moody silence, the soldiers tense and irritable, punctuated by the distant echoes of other searchers. After some time, their squad vanguard finally called a stop, and Mikkel and Tennik were called up to examine an immensely heavy iron gate blocking their path. Mikkel pressed his face to the grate and noted the way the light from his lantern disappeared into the darkness beyond without revealing any walls.
"I've heard stories that the Kaz sealed up a lot of these tunnels decades before I was born," he said. "We've reached the first chamber. Get to blasting."
One of the soldiers kicked at the gate.
"It's solid, sir. If the room is still closed up, can't we count out the chances of them being enemy bases?"
"These chambers have more than one entrance," Tennik said. "We're going to do a proper job of this."
Mikkel retreated a few hundred yards back up the tunnel while the squad sapper worked. He listened to echoes coming down to them from a side passage, and once even saw the bobbing of a lantern.
He wondered if Jatura was down here somewhere, having caught wind of the manhunt and desperately trying to avoid the searchers.
He caught Tennik's eye.
"I've been thinking."
"Oh?"
Tennik asked. "We've been down here for over an hour, and we've only seen one single other squad."
"So?"
"So, there are 4,000 soldiers searching these tunnels. I get the feeling the catacombs are bigger than we considered."
"Not much we can do about it now."
Mikkel thought about some of the maps in his satchel, the ones there'd be no time to copy. Many of them were half-finished, sometimes contradicting the more complete maps, and other times hinting at the idea that there were tunnels that went far deeper, down below the base of the plateau. He wrestled with the fear that they'd just drive Jatura down into the farthest reaches without a prayer of catching him.
There was a distant boom, and Mikkel and Tennik headed back to their squad to find the path ahead of them cleared. The heavy grate blasted along the edges and pushed off to one side of the tunnel. Mikkel ducked through the remains and into the first of the chambers, raising his lantern to get a good look.
Tennik gave a low whistle.
"These aren't chambers, Mikkel. These are damn temples."
He didn't seem far off. The rooms were much larger than the map indicated, with vaulted, cavernous ceilings and a width that was large enough to accommodate most theatres. The floors were covered in dust, the walls slick. At second glance, Mikkel realized that it may very well be a theatre or conference room of some kind, as apparent seating had been carved into about two-thirds of the room in a half-moon shape. There was no evidence that anyone had been in here for a long time. Mikkel studied the floor, looking for footprints in the dust, mildly disappointed that he didn't find any, beyond those of the soldiers who'd just entered with him. He crossed clear to the other side, where he found, per his map, a narrow tunnel leading to the next chamber.
"Chamber clear," one of the soldiers reported. "Then we keep moving,"
Mikkel responded. Mikkel and his squad searched chamber after chamber for hours. They moved methodically, following a path he'd laid out on his map, so that they could search criss-crossing chambers without the risk of someone getting behind them. They found a dozen paths leading back to the general maze of the catacombs, most of which were still sealed off. Occasionally, they came across one that had rusted through or been blasted in decades ago by looters. It was almost noon when Mikkel checked his pocket watch and called for a halt in one of the larger chambers they'd attended. This one appeared to be some sort of communal living space, complete with old notches at regular intervals along the walls where torches might have been lit 1,000 years ago.
Mikel was exhausted and more than a little emotionally frayed. Even without any real excitement, he found the inky darkness battering to his nerves. The uncertainty was taking its toll, and every time they entered a new chamber, he wondered if they would trigger some ancient trap or encounter a collapsed tunnel or lose a man to madness in the claustrophobic area. Add on to all of that his exhaustion. They'd searched all through the night for 10 hours straight, and he felt ready to collapse.
"Do we have a depth?" Tenik asked quietly.
Mikel could see the same exhaustion in Tenik's eyes, and took a moment to pull out his maps, looking carefully at the chambers. Decades ago, a thoughtful cartographer had given a depth for each chamber, but many of the numbers were worn off, and Mikel had no idea how accurate the legible ones actually were.
80 feet below street level, Mikel responded.
Tenik ran a hand through his hair.
Damn, it feels like we're so much deeper. I can throw a rock 80 feet.
Mikel echoed the sentiment. To be so close to the city, probably just 50 or 60 feet below the basement floor of the Capitol building, and yet be so removed from the world made him feel a little crazy. He looked around at each of the soldiers, wondering who would snap first, and curious if anyone from any of the other search parties had snapped already. He let his eyes fall to the box of string held by a soldier, forcing himself to remember that if he began to get twitchy, he could just follow that string right back to the surface. It was just fine. No chance of being trapped down here.
"Do you think someone else has caught him already?" a soldier asked.
"Well, if they have," Mikel said, "they're supposed to send someone down our string to find us and let us know. But that could take 2 hours on its own."
He cleared his throat and checked his watch.
"We've got about an hour left until we're meant to head out. We're only about,
he unrolled his map and traced their path,
800 yards from an exit.
He pointed at the closest doorway into the next chamber.
"We'll head in that direction. Don't worry, fellas. We'll be back in the sunlight before too long."
There were a few "yes, sirs," but most of them sullenly stared at their feet. Mikel wasn't sure whether they were as frayed as he was from the oppressive rock, or if they were tired and angry at not having found Shatura. He opened his mouth, trying to think of something to say to cheer them up, when a voice came to him from across the chamber.
"Sir?" the voice echoed in Dionys. "I think I've found something."
Mikel exchanged a glance with Tenik and got to his feet, heading across the wide space toward a lantern light off in the distance. He soon found a Dionys soldier standing beside a stone table of some sort, just a few feet from a separate exit that headed in the opposite direction from their planned path. She smiled tightly at him and nodded to the ground. The dust outside the tunnel entrance had been disturbed recently, enough that Mikel couldn't make out many single footprints, just a trail leading down into the darkness. Inside the tunnel, stashed behind the table the soldier stood behind, were 6 small barrels of black powder. Mikel nudged each of them with his toe. All but one was empty. He knelt beside them, breath held, and turned the barrels upside down. Burned into the bottom of each barrel was a single rose.
"These are from Black Hat storage," Mikel said, eyeing the path into the darkness.
He looked up at Tenik, then the soldier who'd made the discovery.
"Mom," Mikel said, "you may just have found Landfall's #1 enemy of the state."
"Everyone on your feet! There's been a change of plans!"
Chapter 62 Stike found Colonel Willen late the next morning as he rode through the gate of the curtain wall surrounding New Starlight. The camp appeared in much the same order as the night before, with everyone relaxed and playing games to pass the time, but Stike thought he could sense a tension among the men that hadn't been there before.
Stike? Willan greeted him, riding up and falling in beside Amric.
Willan,
Stike returned with a nod.
Where is your palo man?
Jackal is with my scouts.
Good, good. My sister sent some of her best out last night, and more this morning. General Tabori assures us that the Dianais have abandoned the area, but I think having some of us out there will put the men at ease.
Willan seemed anything but at ease. His jacket was unbuttoned at the collar, and he looked like he hadn't slept well. His hair must.
Has Tabori emerged?
Stike asked, nodding to the citadel.
He has not.
Willan grimaced and shifted in the saddle as he spoke.
Just messages. It seems that Lady Chancellor Lindet's orders have left the general staff in some confusion. They will remain in deliberation until they have come to a consensus as to what to do next.
Stike considered Devore's assurances, as well as the lack of communication. He did not trust the bastard before, and he certainly didn't trust him now. But what could he be playing at? There was a whole field army here, holding a powerful fortress on the tip of the hammer. He had put the army, who clearly were still loyal for Trastans, in an excellent defensive position. If Devore planned betrayal, what could he gain out here?
So I can't talk with him yet.
You can't, Willan replied apologetically. I'm sure that we'll have some sort of decision by the end of the night. Tabori is a persuasive man. The brigadiers will be lined up behind him before too long.
Stike nearly voiced his suspicions that Tabori was planning some kind of treachery, but decided to bite his tongue. Willan was an army man, and Stike doubted that he'd take well to an officer being slandered without evidence.
But what evidence was there?
Willan seemed nervous about the lack of communication, but he wasn't falling apart.
Did you ever find out if the Dianais spiked the cannon when they left?
Oh, I did at that. The cannon were not spiked. I'll confess, that has given me some confusion. It's the first thing we would do if we abandoned a fort to the enemy.
Yeah, Stike muttered. Me too.
Louder, he said.
Are you familiar with this place at all?
Some. I was stationed here for a few months just after the war. My sister pulled some strings to get me transferred to Little Starland.
I don't suppose you know of any way into the citadel.
Willan tapped the side of his chin.
I don't, but, he laughed to himself. Actually, I do. There are a few sea gates out on the breakers. You can only reach them during low tide. The garrison uses them to clean detritus off the breakers and access the lighthouse out past the bay.
Tunnels? Dark, dangerous, and very wet. Can they be reached without a long swim?
Willan considered this. Might be. The North Sea Gate comes out on the mainland, but it's right into the rocks. Even at low tide, those breakers get hit hard enough to wash a man out to sea. A bell rang high up in the citadel, turning Stike's head. He searched for the source of the sound, only to find it hidden from him by one of the towers. He breathed in deeply, the scent of the sea filling his nostrils.
Is there a storm coming in?
Might be, Willan replied.
I'm gonna check. Thank you for your help.
Stike snapped the reins gently, allowing Amric to carry him away from Willan and toward the northern shore of the hammer. He kept his eyes on the walls of the citadel as he approached, searching in vain for any sign of life. The bell, he realized, had awakened something in him. He couldn't determine what,
but there was a tightness in his chest that had nothing to do with his recent uneasiness. No, he felt a certainty, the certainty of a storm on the horizon or the violence of a battle, and with this certainty was a sense that he must act quickly. He forced the feeling down and proceeded to where the citadel met the earth and plummeted down into the ocean. Tying Amrek to a bush, he searched the underbrush until he found a narrow groundskeeper's trail that led down along the rocky cliff and then skirted the edge of the citadel all the way to the ocean. Fetching his carbine and knife, he headed down the trail. It was a difficult walk, but by no means impossible. He passed a narrow bridge leading out to a low gun platform, sitting exposed and empty with 3 12-pound cannons protecting the harbour. He continued on and soon found his boots crunching along the gravelly shoreline. There was a narrow beach here, protected by the breakers, the sound of the ocean crashing against them drowning out anything else he might hear. He followed the beach along the foundation stones of the citadel and around one of the towers, then climbed up and over a boulder until he had a plain view of the docks beneath New Starlight. The docks were not expansive, large enough, perhaps, for a handful of ocean-going vessels. They were tucked into a beach much like the one Stike had just crossed, protected from the open ocean by a stretch of man-made breakers. On one end of the beach, a path led up into the citadel. Stike looked for a way to reach the docks. A small boat might do it, if he could find one. Willen had been right about the ocean, though, and it was clear that even a strong swimmer would get dashed against the breakers at the base of the citadel. He eyed those breakers, following them along the course of the steep shoreline, until he spotted a grate about 50 yards from his current vantage point. The sea gate that Willen had told him about. Stike was about to climb down to the breakers when something caught his eye. There was a ship coming in quickly, sailing in from the west. Stike squinted into the wind and was shocked to see that it flew the sunflower yellow of the Fortrasten flag. Settling back onto the boulder, he watched it come closer. It was only when the ship was almost to the docks that he spotted more on the horizon. 10, 20, maybe even more. There were frigates, transports, and ships of the line, all of Cressian design. He leaned forward enthralled, wishing he had his looking-glass with him. He had thought that the Dianais owned this coast, and as the lead ship came up to dock and dropped anchor, he tried to figure out how a fleet this size could materialize on the other side of the continent from landfall. There was a scrape of metal on stone, and Stike looked around sharply, searching for the source of the sound. He thought he heard voices on the wind, but when he could not find them, he turned his attention back to the ship coming into dock. The minutes slowly ticked by, and the wind picked up, the sky growing darker despite sundown being several hours away. Men scrambled through the rigging of the ship, rolling the sails, and a plank was rolled out. Stike was just about to turn around and leave when he saw a familiar figure appear on deck. Lindet.
Oi!
He shouted, waving both arms. There was no response, and no one on the ship seemed to notice, his voice buried by the sound of the waves on the breakers. He looked once more for a way to the docks and didn't find one. Irritated, he hurried down from his boulder and across the hidden beach to the groundskeeper's path.
Lindet was here.
No wonder Devorian the Third had been in a hurry. This was some kind of damned rendezvous. All those ships out there, that was probably all that was left of the Fortrasten fleet. They'd picked up Lindet from the coast off Redstone and brought her down here to meet with the Third, where she could take command and sweep the hammer clear of Dianais, just as Willen had said. Stike almost laughed at himself for being such a fool. Devorah's secrecy was damn well explained away by this. Linda didn't want anyone to know that she was taking the fight to the Dionysos personally until she was on hand. He tried to figure out how this changed his own plans. The moment she discovered his presence, she would attempt to commandeer the Mad Lancers. If she found out about Carpol, that would... Well, Stike wasn't going to let her find out about Carpol. He was about halfway up the path when he passed the narrow bridge leading to the gun platform and froze in place at the sight of some 15 men, having appeared from seemingly thin air, working over the guns. They cleaned the barrels, brought ammunition up from a cache in the floor, and pointed to the distant ships. It wasn't the men themselves that startled him so much as their appearance. Every one of them wore a turquoise uniform, a Morian-style helmet, and a smooth breastplate. They had red hair and ashen freckles. Stike changed directions in mid-step and hurled himself across the bridge. He was among them before they even saw him, his knife flashing, and within the minute he was coated in their blood and gore. Heart hammering, Stike looked toward the beach, only for his view to be obstructed by the corner of the citadel. Goddamn Tavori was a traitor. This was Lindert's rendezvous, and Tavori had turned it into a death trap. Somewhere far above him, there was a flash in one of the citadel towers, and then the report of a coastal gun. More followed quickly, and Stike was suddenly all too aware that the Third Army was now sitting at the base of an enemy citadel whose guns were being manned by Dionysos. He wiped the blood from his face and began to run.
Chapter 63 Laura rode past a field of the dead and dying, listening as their moans seemed to keep tempo with a clip-clop of her horse's hooves. Another reckless charge by Dionysos dragoons meant to do nothing more than slow down her column. At a glance, there were no more than 100 of them, not even close to enough to do any real damage. Their horses had already been either put down or taken, and the Adran dead buried beneath simple stone cairns beside the road. The Dionysos, wounded and dead alike, lay where they fell and remained ignored as the Riflejack rearguard marched past them. She wondered if anyone had bothered to tell her about this attack. Perhaps. She was exhausted from days of forced march, barely able to sleep even when she did have the time. These attacks had come so frequently that they hardly warranted her attention anymore. They came at night. In the rain, even out in the open, as the Dionysos general sent his cavalry along every goat path and mining trail he could find to try to flank the Riflejacks, to try to trip them up and force the column to slow, even for 15 minutes at a time. She wanted to dismiss the attacks as a waste of the enemy's resources, but the truth was, they were working. Despite the larger, more cumbersome army, the Dionysos infantry remained just 3 hours behind the Riflejacks. Flora felt like she could barely breathe. Up ahead, her column snaked down through the foothills and onto a relatively flat plain, where the vanguard had pulled off to the side for a few moments' rest, allowing another company to take the lead of the column. She searched for Olam and was unable to find him. The sound of galloping hooves made her turn to find Taniel and Noreen coming up the road from the west, covered in the dust stirred up by Vlora's infantry. Noreen wore a tired but satisfied smile, and Taniel held his rifle across the saddle horn. He pulled in next to Vlora and tapped on the side of his head.
"That's all of them."
"All of who?" she asked.
"As far as we can tell, we've popped every privileged and boni in the Dionysos army. We've also killed half their senior officers."
"And yet still they come hard on our heels." Flora had meant to say that in her head, but it came out without her even realizing she was speaking. Noreen nodded.
They are persistent.
Flora looked back toward the dead and dying Dionysus dragoons from the last ambush, unable to get rid of the weight of dread sitting in the pit of her stomach.
You've done well,
she told Noreen.
Go find some chow.
Noreen headed up the column, leaving Flora and Taniel alone by the side of the road.
I don't like the look on your face, Taniel said.
I don't like the fact that we can't gain even an hour on these bastards. They won't slow down, even with their officers and sorcerers dead.
She gestured to the dead dragoons.
They're throwing lives in front of us with as little regard as if they were tossing caltrops in a road.
The zeal scares you?
It terrifies me. I have a little voice in the back of my head, whispering every few minutes that we're all going to die on this blasted continent.
She rolled her shoulders, trying to calm herself.
I'm not thrilled with the idea of dying, but there are worse fates. Dying, hunted like a dog. It feels like our campaign through northern Kes during the war all over again. Except this time, I'm the one responsible for all these lives.
She looked Taniel in the eye.
I don't want all these men to die here, Taniel.
Taniel's expression was grim.
You're doing the best you can.
She wondered at his plans. He wasn't an Adran, not anymore. He was stronger, faster, and sturdier than any normal human, even any powder mage. And when the Dionysus finally trapped the Riflejacks and slaughtered them to the last man, Taniel would no doubt carve his way out and disappear into the hills, heading across the continent to reunite with Karpol. Flora briefly considered grabbing Olam and attempting to run for it. But who would she be if she abandoned the soldiers who so willingly sacrificed themselves for her? Another thought crept up and touched the back of her mind. She flirted with it for a moment before shoving it to one side, where it waited, insistently, for her to consider it again.
"I've got to talk with Olam," she told Taniel.
She turned and followed Noreen up the column, riding past the dust-coated soldiers, down out of the foothills, and onto the wide field where the column ground to a halt for a brief rest. Beyond the field was something that her maps called Ishtari's Crease. It was a great upthrusting of rock, as severe as a church's steeple, that ran north to south for about 30 miles. It varied between 40 and 80 feet tall, and was occasionally broken by natural fissures or modern clefts blasted out for roadways. Beyond the crease, the land fell steeply down into an old-growth forest, beyond which one could just make out the distant plains that needed to be crossed before reaching the ocean. Those plains had haunted her thoughts for days like a waking nightmare. Flat and open, with few defensible positions, the larger Dionysus field army would be able to slow and surround the Riflejacks, cutting them to ribbons without the need of either tactical or sorcerous advantages. To outrun them, the Riflejacks needed at least a day's lead on their enemy. They had mere hours. Flora found Olam in a deep conference with the company's quartermasters. He spotted Flora and broke off, coming to her side, where he gave her a tight smile.
"We've sent the capstone on ahead while the column rests. Our scouts are telling us that we won't have to worry about being flanked by Dionysus cavalry for a while. There isn't another place to cross the crease for miles, so they'll either have to come straight up behind us or wait until we're completely through."
There was a hint of suggestion in his words. It didn't take a military genius to see that the crease was a tactician's wet dream. The road passed through a rocky divide less than 20 yards across, easily defended by a few hundred men, let alone a few thousand. Quietly, so as not to be overheard, she said,
"We're going to die, whether we fight them here or out on the plains."
"The thought had crossed my mind," Olam answered.
"I'd rather not die at all."
"We can attempt to negotiate,"
Flora scoffed. And give them time to catch up with us and manoeuvre. You remember the negotiation before Windy River?
Things might have changed. We can try to give them the capstone.
Somehow I'm not sure that'll be enough.
Flora eyed the crease.
In another situation, she might have found it beautiful in a rugged way. The cracked, broken rock was periodically flushed with green, where a group of shrubs or trees had managed to eke out its existence. It wasn't, she decided, a terrible monument to make one's gravestone.
If we attempt to last stand here, how long will it take for the Dionys to find another crossing and come around behind us?
A day and a half for the cavalry, 2.5 for infantry.
Olam paused.
There's the option of leaving a few hundred men to defend the pass. It would easily buy the rest of the army time to get a head start on the plains.
Flora shot Olam a glare. You think I should ask for suicidal volunteers?
I'm confident we could get enough volunteers to hold the pass.
There was a glint in Olam's eye that Flora didn't like.
And I suppose you'd volunteer to lead them.
Olam clenched his jaw, but did not answer. Flora knew him well enough to see that as a yes.
Out of the question.
She paused.
How long do we plan on resting here?
No more than half an hour. Then we'll send the vanguard through the crease.
Make it 15 minutes. We need to talk again in 10, just over that ridge over there. She pointed to where the road passed through the crease.
In private.
I'll be there.
Flora took her leave and headed along the column, her eyes searching the faces of her soldiers as they rested on the side of the road, jackets unbuttoned and packs thrown to the ground. The looks of exhaustion as she rode past them made her heart cry out with every salute and respectful General Flint that followed her. The problem, she found, was that Olam was a far more popular person with the soldiers than she was. They respected her, for certain, but they loved Olam. And that made what she had to do next especially difficult. It took her a few minutes to discover a pair of faces up near the vanguard, and she dismounted and walked over to the two men lying a little off their own from the main column. One was smaller, with a narrow face and thoughtful eyes, while the second was well over 6 feet tall and had the languid manner of a mastiff flying in the sun. The two friends were former boxers who joined up with her during the Kez Civil War. She'd used them for dirty side jobs on more than one occasion.
"Boys," she said, standing above them.
The big one, Pugh, squinted at Flora from under his hat, and then leapt to his feet with a snapped salute, kicking his companion Dez sharply in the ribs as he did so.
"Mom!"
Flora waited until they were both standing.
"At ease, soldiers. I need a favour."
"Anything for you, Mom," Dez responded.
"Anything?"
"You set up Pugh's mama with that good job in Adipust. And you made sure my little brother didn't fall in with the gangs. That's worth a lot, Mum."
Flora gave them a tired smile.
"First, I want you to answer a question with complete honesty. I will not hold any answer you give me against you in any way."
"Of course, Mum," Pugh said.
"If I and Colonel Olam were both standing in front of you and gave you conflicting orders, whose would you obey?"
The eyes of both men widened. Pugh swallowed hard.
"Mum."
"Honest answers."
"I," Des said, "I suppose it would be yours, Mum."
"You suppose?"
"It would be, Mum," he said firmly.
Pugh echoed the sentiment.
"Good. Get some rope and meet me up on that ridge. Right there, behind that boulder."
Flora leaned against the boulder and watched as Olam, Dez, and Pugh together walked up the road toward her. She wondered whether this was a mistake, and forced herself to dismiss the notion. Sometimes a thing had to be done to preserve lives. She wiped a few tears from the corners of her eyes and forced a gentle smile onto her face as the men reached her. Olam was already concerned. She could see it in his eyes, though he didn't want to show it in front of the other two.
"What's going on?"
he asked her. She jerked her head to the side, indicating the three men follow her behind the boulder, out of the sight of eyes of the army below them. Once they were secluded, she said,
"Pew, I would appreciate it if you would disarm and restrain Colonel Olam."
"What?" Olam managed, before Pew slipped behind him and wrapped Olam in a bear hug that pinned Olam's arms to his chest. Dez jumped forward and took Olam's pistol, sword, and knife, before returning to Vlora's side. Despite their compliance, both men looked more than a little startled by the order, and clearly expected an explanation.
"What's going on?"
Olam asked through clenched teeth, his eyes full of anger and hurt. Vlora took a shaky breath.
"This is what's going on. In 5 minutes, Colonel Herakish is going to give the order to move out. He'll remain in command for the next 2 days, while Pew and Dez quietly trundle you along with instructions not to let you out of their sight or allow you to speak with anyone. At the end of those 2 days, you will be released, and Herakish will relinquish command of the Riflejacks to you."
Olam began to struggle. "What the pit do you mean by all of this?"
"I mean..." Vlora heard her voice crack and turned away, unable to face Olam while she spoke. "I'm going to stay and defend the Crease," she said.
"What? On your own?"
"Yes, on my own."
She glanced over to find Olam's eyes wide with shock. Pew's mouth hung open.
It should give the Riflejacks time to get a lead on their pursuers.
Olam suddenly jerked backward, slamming his head into Pew's chin. The big soldier reeled back, releasing him for long enough that Olam leapt for the road, clearly intent on heading back to the army to forestall this order. Dez tackled his legs, and he and Pew dragged him, kicking and struggling, back behind the rock. Together, they began to bind Olam. Dez stuffed a rag into his mouth. Vlora squatted next to Olam as he was restrained, unable to help the tears that ran down her face as he glared at her.
"I'm sorry," she told him. "I'm not going to let anyone else die for my ambitions, for my mistakes. Not the Riflejacks, and certainly not you. I know you're going to be angry. Please don't take it out on Pew and Dez or Herakish. They're only following my orders."
She wanted to say 1,000 things, but her stomach clenched so badly she thought she might vomit if she continued to speak.
"I love you, Olam."
She leaned forward, kissing him on the forehead, then stepped away. "Keep him quiet until the army has made it 20 or 30 miles, she told Pew and Dez, "and definitely don't say anything to my majors. If they ask questions, refer them to Herakish." She nodded at them, forcing a smile.
"Thanks, boys. I hope I'll be alive to pay you back."
Olam was bound at their feet, his face red and streaked with tears. The two soldiers straightened and snapped salutes.
"I wish it hadn't come to this, Mum," Pew said.
"So do I," Vlora answered.
"It's been an honour to serve under you," Dez said. "I know every man in the brigade would say the same. We'll never forget you."
"I appreciate it. Now, get him out of here before I lose my nerve."
Chapter 64 Mikkel followed the footsteps in the dust as the tunnel plummeted deeper into the ground. It passed through several more chambers, with no indication that anyone had stopped in any of them. At one point, Mikel consulted his maps to see that he was within arm's length of the chamber labelled Mara on his map. He hesitated, peering at the dark doorway, wondering if